This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today, we begin on the grounds of the West Los Angeles VA, a big campus near the 405, overseen by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. 400 acres of medical facilities for military vets, old buildings, an open space, lots of big, empty lawns. You're standing on one of those lawns, by the way, which is partly filled with rows of camping tents, about 50 of them. The West LA VA recently opened up this property to veterans experiencing homelessness as an alternative to sleeping on the sidewalk. The VA provides tents and bathrooms, meals, medical care, even social services. And KCRW reporter Anna Scott recently visited this campsite, found that for some, it is a refuge, and now city of LA officials, are looking at starting their own government-run homeless encampments. But not everyone is enthusiastic about the idea. Anna, welcome to you.
Hi, Steve.
This is a follow-up story to what you talked about last week. A lot of tents along San Vicente Boulevard, Wilshire Boulevard, near the VA campus. This is actually on the VA campus. So what do the vets think about staying in these tents?
Well, I was there this week and I talked to a handful of people, and some are finding it to be a refuge. Some say that it's a much easier transition than going into a program with more rigmarole around entering, and that there's a special camaraderie that they've found. Like one guy I talked to, whose name is Albert Gutierrez, he's an Army veteran who deals with trauma from his time in Iraq and from one attack in particular.
I was hit by my arm and my leg by shrapnel, so yeah. Don't really like to talk about it too much. I just find, you know, support here. The best part is just to be outside and be amongst other veterans right now.
Others there, though, describe it as just a really small step up from living on the streets. Like Jeffrey Powers, another person I spoke to there who's a Navy veteran.
I would say that it's a net plus. There are some things that they could work on. For example, we have no showers. And, you know, you shouldn't have to drive to take a shower.
Now, he did say that the VA provides rides to a nearby Y so that they can shower. But, you know, this is still camping. And the point is that it's missing some basic amenities that you would find even at a shelter.
What's the idea here, Anna? Is the West LA VA trying to take care of homeless veterans? That's what they're doing? Or are they just giving up and saying, all right, here are some tents, you know, go forth. We're going to help you as much as we can, but you're still homeless.
Yeah, well, the VA definitely would not characterize it as giving up, but more as a new path out of homelessness. So they opened this campsite up in April, which was after the pandemic hit. And, you know, so for years, homeless veterans have camped outside of the VA campus because many receive services there. And with the shutdown, the thinking was, well, let's at least give them a safer space to camp in. And while they're here, connect them to healthcare, to case managers, to addiction treatment, whatever they need to ideally exit homelessness.
All right. So the idea is to bring them in off the sidewalk and ultimately transition them into housing. How's that working?
Well, it hasn't been operating that long, but officials with the VA say that about 200 veterans have entered the campsite, and almost half have moved on to transitional or temporary housing with the goal of going from there to permanent housing. For the VA, they feel that it's going well enough to expand. This started with 25 tents, now it's at 50, and they've made room for 100.
You know, Anna, on the one hand, it sounds like, right, they're getting some help, they're not suffering, at least on the streets outside of the campus, right, where they were before, on the sidewalks or near traffic. Mm. On the other hand, though, I mean, it's not really solving the homeless issue. I mean, homeless vets are still a thing, and they're still living in tents. They don't have homes.
Right, right. And that's why it's a big deal that the West LA VA is doing this, because having government-run tent cities isn't a new idea, but it is a controversial idea for the exact reason that you were just talking about. Los Angeles hasn't done anything like this for decades because, on the one hand, it does seem like an obvious way to provide people who are homeless with some basic security and humane conditions and to alleviate some of the public health risks of having people living on the streets. But in practice, there are a lot of pitfalls for people to get stuck or for these sites to become a drain on resources that could go to real housing instead.
That danger of getting stuck, you mentioned the word stuck, seems especially true in LA, where there is this large, very large shortage of affordable housing. Also, having this designated campsite doesn't necessarily end street homelessness, right? So, I mean, last week you brought us a story about an encampment, as I mentioned, outside the West LA VA campus where some homeless veterans live. Are those folks still there?
Yeah, they are. So you're talking about the encampment on San Vicente Boulevard that some residents there call Veterans Row. A lot of people there are distrustful of the VA for a variety of reasons, some of which we talked about last week. So there hasn't been a mad rush for all of them to move into this sanctioned encampment. That's, by the way, just on the other side of a gate on San Vicente there. But some people who I've met at Veterans Row are getting assistance through the VA's campsite program and even have tents on the property, but still spend most of their time at the unofficial encampment outside.
At least, I guess, it's another access point for them to get services. I mean, they're getting some basic services, too.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, it's also worth noting, just in terms of the concerns here, that the West LA VA is uniquely set up to try this kind of thing because they have this big property with healthcare on site and even transitional housing on the property. And there are a lot more permanent housing resources for homeless veterans than for non-veterans. So it's still a challenge, but it's less of a challenge in moving people through something like this than you might have with the more general population.
Well, let's talk about the general population then. Does it make for a good model or a bad model for other parts of LA? Are there plans to try it somewhere else?
Well, there are no concrete plans yet, but it is being considered. At least two city council members are looking at this. This week, I talked to Mike Bonin's office and Joe Buscaino's office, and they're both looking at possible sites for tent cities. Now, Buscaino says he only wants to go through with it if he can also resume sanitation sweeps of the sidewalk encampments nearby, because he doesn't want a situation like at the West LA VA where you have side-by-side official and unofficial encampments.
And if we do see this tent city model expand in Los Angeles, how do you keep the campsites from becoming permanent? I mean, and make sure people just aren't getting marooned in them, or is, again, back to that word, stuck?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. And it's really hard to answer until there are more permanent, affordable housing options in Los Angeles, because even with the system that we have now, people are getting stuck at every stage. But here's the other thing. If you're worried about encampments becoming an entrenched part of life in Los Angeles, have you been outside lately? You know, they are. And with the shutdown and gyms closing and libraries closing, even some food pantries, I'm more and more seeing volunteers and activists going to encampments without permission from the city or the county and providing things like water, food, phone charging tables, even mobile showers and bathrooms.
I mean, people want to feel like they're doing something, right?
Yeah, we've seen this at Echo Park, and it's at Veterans Row, which is the unofficial encampment right by the VA property. There's one formerly homeless veteran who you heard from in my story from last week, Rob, who goes around the city looking for currently homeless vets to bring them there to that encampment. And once they're there, whether or not they enroll in VA programs, there are a whole bunch of community members who help with basic survival assistance. I was there last night, and I met a woman named Tara Brennan. She's a food industry executive who lives nearby. And three nights a week, she throws a barbecue on Veterans Row with donated supplies and a little portable grill.
It's fired up. Taco Tuesday is a hit always. Okay. I use really beautiful ground sirloin that gets donated to us. And then the guys love their jalapeno.
And she said she got involved after just driving by enough times.
It didn't sit right that I would pass this encampment, which was getting busier and busier, and have my children say, "Why are they hungry?"
And, you know, Steve, I think a lot of people are asking questions like that right now. And by the way, I asked the West LA VA what they think about people providing freelance services to this unofficial encampment right by the campus. And they basically said it's fine, that it's another way to get homeless veterans the help they need.
Until we can find a more permanent solution, which, of course, is the never-ending process, right? It seems. KCRW's Anna Scott, who covers housing and homelessness. Anna, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, continuing on with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatti.
Let me hear another one. I might have missed it.
Protesters continue to decry the death of another black man at the hands of law enforcement. On Monday afternoon, LA County Sheriff's deputies stopped 29-year-old Dijon Kizzy, who'd been riding his bicycle in the Westmont neighborhood of South LA for what they call violations of vehicle codes. We're still not sure what that means. The sheriff's department says the shooting happened after they say Kizzy punched a deputy and then started running, and that they found a gun among items that he dropped, including some clothing, on the ground at the scene. Deputy shot Kizzy multiple times, some reports saying dozens of times. And meanwhile, in another sheriff's department shooting from earlier this summer, there's more information coming out about what happened when deputies shot and killed 18-year-old Andres Guardado in Gardena. A whistleblower at the department now claims there may have been some kind of interdepartment gang initiation involved in that shooting. A lot to unpack here, and Celeste Freeman from the website Witness LA is here to help us understand what's going on. Hey, Celeste.
Hey, Steve. It's quite a period, boy.
Yeah, I want to start with what happened this week, the most recent thing, which happened on Monday. There's no police body cam video of the shooting of Dijon Kizzy because the sheriff's department doesn't yet use body cams. Yesterday, the LA County Board of Supervisors voted to provide more than $25 million for a rollout of body cams. The LAPD has had them for several years, 5 years now. What's taken so long for the sheriff's department?
Well, to some degree, we can't quite blame our current sheriff for this. Our previous sheriff, Jim McDonnell, was a foot dragger on the body cam issue, and it just couldn't seem to get pushed through. But unfortunately, even when the body cams roll out in October, they're only going to be at, I believe, five stations. The rollout isn't going to be complete. It's going to be staged. From some perspectives, I'm sure that's an easier way to do it. But when we have everything going on that we have right now with police shootings, not having body cams for the fourth largest law enforcement agency in the nation is not good.
And we have yet another shooting, deputy involved shooting, where, you know, if there had been a body cam on these deputies, we would see what had happened.
Right.
Do you think that will accelerate the process to get more body cams on more deputies?
I don't know if it's going to accelerate the process because the process is complicated. It would be good if it did, but with the Kizzy shooting, which is the shooting you're talking about, that's the most recent, where this young man appears to have been shot a minimum of 12 times, and, you know, maybe a lot more, or maybe 20 or in excess of 20. And what we got yesterday from the sheriff's department is that Mr. Kizzy was on a bike and was being stopped by deputies for some vehicle code infraction. And then he dropped the bike, took off, and the deputies chased him, and he was carrying some bundle of clothing which almost looked like, you know, a bit of laundry, and he dropped it. And reportedly, when he dropped it, there was a gun inside. So the deputies opened up on him and shot him this extraordinary number of times, when, as far as we know, if he was armed, he wasn't armed anymore because everyone admits that the gun was down. But now then, yesterday, what we got is Mr. Kizzy was, when they shot him, he was leaning over and starting to reach for the gun. And whether that's true or not, we have no way of knowing. But if we had a body cam, we'd know if that was true, because that's, of course, an easy thing to say when it's really the word of the deputies against people viewing this from a great distance.
Let's shift now to Andres Guardado. This shooting happened earlier in the summer, back in June. The board yesterday, Celeste, also decided to look into the possibility of suing the sheriff's department over its unwillingness to share information about that shooting in Gardena. What's the backstory to that? And why does the Board of Supervisors think it's necessary to sue its own sheriff's department or even the sheriff himself?
Well, first of all, the sheriff put a hold on the coroner's report, which happens from time to time. And then the sheriff will not allow the Office of the Inspector General to really have the ability to investigate or be present when investigations are going on in very controversial shootings like this one, or in a lot of other situations where civilian oversight is really needed and appropriate. Yesterday at the board meeting, Max Huntsman, the inspector general, was talking about, once again, he can get nothing, and his computer access to files that he had under Sheriff Jim McDonald is completely shut off. And the sheriff is actually still engaged in a criminal investigation against the inspector general, which does not suggest cooperation. So the motion yesterday pretty much lays a gun on the table and says, if you don't cooperate, you know, if you don't, we are empowered to enforce the need for cooperation.
I want to talk about this whistleblower who came out this week, a whistleblower who works at the Compton office of the Sheriff's Department. The department's been under fire for alleged gangs of deputies operating at some of its bureaus. There's one gang called the Executioners. The deputy who shot and killed Guardado works in the Compton office, a guy named Miguel Vega. Now, another deputy, this whistleblower, says that Vega was trying to become a member of the Executioners. Let's hear from the whistleblower.
How about this latest shooting of Andres Guardado? Was that done by an inked member or a prospect of the Executioners?
Prospect.
And who was that prospect? You know?
Lax Foundation. Speculation and conjecture on the part of the witness.
Deputy Vega and Deputy Hernandez.
Deputy Vega, you just heard. An inked member, you heard inked member, is someone with the tattoo. So Deputy Vega may have been chasing ink. This is what the whistleblower claims, trying to become a member of this deputy gang called the Executioners. Why is that important in this case, Celeste?
Well, the Executioners, from what we know, and Witness LA has some sources inside Compton, you know, is aggressive, seems to have an us versus them perspective between themselves and the community. And what we know from our own sources inside the Compton station is that the deputy who shot Andres Guardado, his training officer is high up in the Executioners and was considered to some degree an enforcer. In fact, he's been named by two other whistleblowers as someone who beat down another deputy who he didn't think was hardcore enough. And that guy, who is an executioner, was the training officer for this deputy who shot Mr. Guardado.
So much information, obviously, to talk about. Celeste Freeman from Witness LA helping us understand some important news at the Sheriff's Department. Celeste, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Onward now with KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Planes, trains, and automobiles. No, it's not a movie. They are three things that have something in common. You have to pay to be in one these days, and commuting on any of those can be expensive. So what if I told you that LA Metro, the transportation agency operating LA County's rails and buses, wants to make future rides on all rail lines and buses free? As in F-R-E-E, gratis, no charge. Metro's exploring, that's a key word by the way, exploring the idea of going fareless by the year 2021. It is a lofty agenda item for an agency that is reeling from low ridership during the pandemic and an agency that struggled to entice plenty of Angelenos out of cars to begin with. Could going fareless finally be the thing to do it? Alyssa Walker is urbanism editor at Curbed and a regular contributor here at Greater LA, and she's here with some answers. Hey, Alyssa.
Hello, Steve.
You're somebody who rides those rails and the buses, too. Walk us through this idea. How would it work?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what it would sound like. It would be free. It would depend on how they would want to do it. You might still need a tap card. They're also moving towards a way to scan a ticket that would just be on your phone. So you might still, you know, scan in and let them know that you're boarding so they can track that, but it wouldn't cost any money. And there are some cities that have done this, including Kansas City and Olympia, Washington, but nothing as big as this would be. You know, Metro would definitely be the biggest agency in the country.
I wonder, Alyssa, because Metro is obviously hurting right now, how could they have the budget to even pull something like this off?
Well, yeah. I mean, we are, like every transit agency, really facing this cliff, this fiscal cliff when it comes to ridership. You know, right now the buses are effectively operating free because we're protecting the drivers from people boarding the bus. So for social distancing, you board on the back of the bus and you don't even get near the tap card reader. So we're not even bringing in money from the limited ridership that we're seeing right now. But we do have some money, you know, tucked away in other parts of Metro. Carter Rubin from NRDC found $10 billion worth of freeway expansion projects, which I feel could probably
billion.
Be tweaked. Metro
a
does
money.
A lot of roadway yeah. investments, right? And then, of course, we have something like the policing budget, you know, and that's, we're looking at like $650 million for the next 5 years. And the board did vote in June to reduce that budget. So we could find money in other places.
It sounds like this announcement is really curious at this moment. I mean, thinking about where we are with the pandemic and the fact that ridership is way down. Nobody wants to be close to anybody at this point. I mean, Metro,
right?
I mean, Metro's announcing this while we're in the midst of you know, this horrible pandemic. And, you know, it's in a budget crisis. How could this possibly help the transit agency?
I mean, this does feel very... much like a PR move in many ways. But I do think we are very uniquely positioned as an agency to try this. You know, as we've said before, when we've talked about this on the show, our fare recovery rate is 13%. That means like the percentage of our operating budget that comes from the fares that you pay when you use your tap card. That's very, very, very low compared to other cities, other transit agencies that really rely on people, you know, riding the buses and trains to keep them going. And then you would see things like, you know, ridership would go up and people would have access to things that they didn't have access to before. And that all those things are, I think, critically important when you're trying to recover from a crisis like this. People don't have a lot of money. People don't have an easy way to get to jobs. So hopefully they have a job. And so this could really, it could really make a difference in people's lives.
And yet at the same time, Metro's board just last week presented a proposal that would cut bus service, right? By a certain amount. What is it, like?
Yes.
20%?
20%. And yeah. This, you know, they said they're still listening to your suggestions. If you have thoughts about that, you should contact Metro's board and let them know. Yeah, these cuts would be devastating to that same group of people I was just talking about, people who rely on transit. You know, one in five renters in LA County missed one or more rental payments. You know, we're just after the first of the month, during the last 6 months, during this pandemic.
Yeah,
people
so much hardship.
Are financially, yes. I mean, the hardship that, you know, that Metro's core ridership is facing is substantial right now. And then you look at, you know, the next gen plan, they had this amazing plan that they're now going to, you know, we're not even going to see that plan if they just make the service cuts. I'm just remembering some of the highlights, like under the next gen goals, like buses would arrive every 5 to 10 minutes for 83% of current riders compared to 49%. That could be life-changing, and we can't give that up. I mean, we still have to keep that as the goal. We want to make sure that more people have access to a cheaper and more reliable way to get around. Some of them might have, you know, lost their cars during this period because people couldn't keep up their car payments.
So I know they convened a task force, Metro did, and yesterday was the first day that they got together. Did anything come out of it?
There is a group of people who are going to be working on this. Metro employees from, you know, across the board who are going to be looking at the impacts, a lot of the things we've discussed, but also, like you said, like how can we get this done as soon as possible and hopefully launch it in 2021. I mean, that would be a timescale that would be just remarkable compared to what other big transit agencies are doing right now, or really just trying to stay alive.
Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor at Curbed and our regular here at Greater LA. Alyssa, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow on this program, you've heard the term fighting fire with fire. It's actually something we can do. Yet controlled burns in California are only good for certain terrains, with heat and dry weather slated for this weekend. And by the way, it's going to get really hot. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us what you're thinking. Subscribe to the podcast. Longer features, longer interviews, special content there as well. And you can listen anywhere and anytime at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Kat Yor, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Sue Margulies, hi Sue, Mike Newport, and Christian Bordahl all make this show happen. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Honored that you lent us your ear today. Have a great night.